what it means to act in the best interest of the company is going to expand. It's going to include scrutinizing and surveying a broader range of stakeholders.
My name is Sarah Carnegie, and I'm the Legal Projects Director at the International Bar Association. Together with my team, the IBA Legal Policy and Research Unit, we've created a series of podcasts on business and sustainability to look at the rapidly increasing need for companies to act responsibly and sustainably, considering not only their legal obligations, but also what is referred to as soft law, which is now hardening at pace. When we refer to soft law in this context, we should start with reference to the cornerstone of the Business and Human Rights Framework, the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights. The UNGPs, as they are known, were unanimously endorsed by the UN Human Rights Council in 2011, exactly 10 years ago. Their aim was to identify and clarify policies and standards for business and human rights. While they do not have legally binding force, the political consensus behind their endorsement established them as the most authoritative global framework to address adverse business impacts on all human rights. The UNGPs rest on three pillars: the state duty to protect against human rights abuses by third parties, including business, the corporate responsibility to respect human rights, and thirdly, the greater access by victims to effective remedy, both judicial and non-judicial. In this episode, IBA business and human rights lawyer Maria Pia Sacco and I are honoured to speak with Professor John Ruggie, the author of the UNGPs, to discuss their impact and future developments in this area. Professor Ruggie was appointed by Kofi Annan as the UN Secretary-General's Special Representative for Business and Human Rights in 2005, and he was tasked with the goal of clarifying the roles and responsibilities of states, companies, and other social actors in the business and human rights sphere. Professor Ruggie, it's fantastic to have you here with us today. Thank you so much. I'll start with, if I may, further acknowledgement that June of 2021 marks the unanimous endorsement by the Human Rights Council of the Guiding Principles, a decade which I'm sure you're fascinated to have both witnessed and also to consider what lies ahead. We know that since their adoption, many countries inside and outside Europe have introduced or considered introducing laws on human rights due diligence or transparency for companies. We also know that the European Commission is expected to present a proposal for an EU-wide legal framework on mandatory human rights and environmental due diligence. So all great progress. At the beginning of your mandate in 2005, could you have imagined that the UN Guiding Principles would have had such an impact and such a following?
Well, there was hope. I can certainly say that. The answer is no, but also a little bit yes. It's no in the sense that there was no way to foresee how this would evolve over time in its specifics, whether it would lead to an OECD agreement or whether it would lead to a treaty negotiation or whether it would lead to nothing. It was impossible to predict. The positive signs were that the guiding principles were endorsed unanimously by the Human Rights Council. That gave them a lot of legitimacy in the eyes of business, which at the time was looking for ways to respond to investor and civil society pressure for dealing with human rights-related problems in their supply chains. And so the businesses became very interested in the guiding principles as a sort of social risk management. So in that sense, that happened fairly early. The involvement of governments took about 5 years. They discovered that the voluntarism of the guiding principles weren't producing the results that they had hoped for. And then governments started to get involved, particularly in the European Union. And from there on, we've moved to today where we have hard law proposals. So, as I say, the answer is no, we couldn't possibly foresee the specifics. But we were always hoping that there would be a sort of a dynamic evolution triggered by the guiding principles, particularly, as it turned out, we were right on this, particularly around the concept of due diligence, because for governments, it provided a focal point, something that they could ask business to do. For business, it provided an approach to social risk management. And for civil society and those adversely affected, due diligence meant that there may be less likelihood of human rights harm that would occur on the ground.
We are, of course, over 16 months now into the global COVID-19 pandemic, which has increased the gulf between the rich and the poor and caused huge and substantial human rights harms. So I wonder whether, in your opinion, the pandemic has accelerated this increased attention that we're seeing into human rights due diligence and the UN guiding principles themselves.
Yes, it clearly has. I should say, though, that the process was underway before. It first showed up in the anti-slavery legislations in the UK and Australia and elsewhere. And the French Loi de Vigilance, which was 2017, before the pandemic. But the pandemic certainly made it clear to everyone involved with these issues that business as usual was not good enough, and that we needed to step up the game. And that's when the proposals started coming out for a sort of a comprehensive approach, not an issue by issue, like modern day slavery or where is timber harvested or where do minerals come from, but an overall comprehensive human rights and later environmental due diligence process.
John, you mentioned the European Parliament resolution. And we know that the European Commission is going to present its proposal for a directive on mandatory human rights and environmental due diligence in the fall this year. Do you expect a Brussels effect?
Well, the EU Parliament has adopted a proposed legislation in itself by an overwhelming majority of 504-79. It does not bind the Commission, but it sends a strong signal. The Commission will put out its own draft sometime in probably midsummer. It is expected that it will apply to any company, no matter what its nationality, any company that operates within the single market. And so there will be a Brussels effect. Precisely how that's going to work, I don't think we know yet. I don't think they have worked it out yet. But there will certainly be a Brussels effect. There are actually two pieces of Commission regulations or directives that are coming out. One, the Sustainable Finance Disclosure Regulation, which is already in effect and requires investment market participants or financial market participants to account for or to show how they account for their ESG risks in their recommendations, in their portfolio constructions. And then also they're required to show the due diligence process whereby they're addressing those risks. So that's on the investor side. And then on the company side, it is or will be a mandatory human rights and environmental due diligence system with extensive disclosure requirements and also legal liability in some form.
The parliamentary proposal clarifies that the directive should also apply to publicly listed SMEs as well as to SMEs operating in high-risk areas. What will the main challenges be for SMEs considering their more limited resources compared to MNEs?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. One of the main sources of opposition to all of this has been from business associations that represent SMEs. And their argument, and I heard it when I was doing my mandate, their argument is these rules are always adopted for large companies, but we don't have the capacity to do what large companies are able to do. We don't have, you know, huge risk management departments and so forth, or capacity, rather. What the European Parliament has done and what the Commission is likely to do is to say, yes, we understand that, and we need to sort of scale down the requirements. But many of you are operating in high-risk environments, and there we need you to be much more careful and to do more serious due diligence. And, you know, as I've said to the BDA, the German Business Association representing the Mittelstand, you can read the newspapers, and you're going to invest in Myanmar, you know you're going to have a problem, or if you, you know, any other place in the Democratic Republic of Congo, you know you're going to have a problem. And so don't shut your eyes, open them and think about where you're getting the material from and how it's being produced.
Do you see any risks of having a checklist approach if these obligations are also imposed on SMEs and auditing companies or certification companies come into play?
Well, both with the guiding principles themselves and also the European Parliament's draft proposal make it very clear that a sort of a checklist approach is inadequate. And the way in which they put that in positive terms is that some form of engagement with likely affected communities is necessary. Now, a small SME may not have the capacity to do on the ground work. So it needs help either from the government. Many governments do already collect risk indicators in various countries, and they can be supplied to the SMEs. Consulting firms, I'm sure, would be very happy to help them. And of course, civil society. But what will not be proper and appropriate is for SMEs simply to say, "Oh, we're so small, and you know we can't do this," and then have a major catastrophe somewhere in their supply chain. That will be made much more difficult by this legislation.
The seventh session of the open-ended Intergovernmental Working Group on Transnational Corporations and Other Business Enterprises with Respect to Human Rights will take place later this year in October 2021, the 25th to the 29th of October, I believe. And there have been two informal online consultations held recently. Can you give me your thoughts on whether you think that the EU's introduction of legislation regarding mandatory human rights due diligence will increase the likelihood of an international treaty on due diligence succeeding in the future?
Well, how far ahead are you looking in the future?
Well, we've got a decade of action, haven't we, that's certainly been put forward by the UN the Sustainable Development Goals.
Let me just say that the current treaty negotiations may be beyond rescue. They got off to a very bad start, as a result of which they've been boycotted by all of the OECD countries. And Russia and China and Brazil have raised all sorts of objections and occasionally have said they don't want a treaty. I think because of its highly politicized origins, even though the draft is improving as time goes on, I don't think it's likely to succeed. That's not to say that at some point in the future, there might not be a new initiative that focuses specifically on the due diligence area. The next step might be through the OECD to expand it to a broader community. It's just a guess. I don't know this. It's just a guess. And eventually it might end up at the global level. But for the current process, I don't see a bright future.
Obviously, the implementation of national reporting laws is varied, and we know that there are real differences and there are inadequacies in some of those laws, which have led many to say, you know, there needs to be more comprehensive mandatory measures. And when we see what the EU plans to do in terms of its impact and what that will look like for businesses doing deals across the EU, it effectively leads, does it not, to some kind of international norm that then exists?
Yes, and the fact that the EU legislation, both on the investor side and on the company side, will have some form of extraterritorial effect. Well, at first, some of the countries that will be affected will probably complain and try to get the effect reduced. But after they don't succeed, it may well increase their interest in a broader instrument. And I suspect that that sentiment will emerge more rapidly within the OECD context than it will at the global level.
I'd like, John, if I may, just to turn to the issue of stakeholder governance or stakeholderism. It depends. It seems to be written in different ways. But I wonder what the impact of a mandatory human rights and environmental due diligence act or law will be on corporate governance, particularly when you think about the Chicago School view of the purpose of a corporation. I'd just be interested to know your thoughts on those issues.
Well, there's been a debate now for a couple of years on the purpose of the corporation. In the U.S., the Business Roundtable issued a statement that companies need to act in a way that takes the interests of a broader set of stakeholders into account. The British Academy did similar things, the World Economic Forum as well. For the first time in, but since the 1970s or 1980s, there is a mainstream debate about the purpose of the corporation. Essentially, for all the wonderful things that have been accomplished by globalization, corporate globalization, global supply chains, and all the rest of it, one negative side effect has been sort of the companies have been able to socialize risk and to privatize reward. And that is coming back now to haunt us, as we see in the degradation of the environment and climate change, in social and economic inequalities, which were heightened by the pandemic. It is getting harder to act like a freedman-like business entity that the shareholder primacy reigns supreme, given those effects.
Do you think that the fiduciary duties of directors and asset managers are going to be affected as well?
My view is that the fiduciary duty of directors will change on their own when you have mandatory due diligence, because their fiduciary duty at the end of the day isn't really to the so-called owners, it's to the company, to act in the best interest of the company. And what it means to act in the best interest of the company is going to expand. It's going to include scrutinizing and surveying a broader range of stakeholders. The board will develop, or will have to develop, additional capacity, appoint advisory committees or appoint subject matter experts to the board. The ideology for the past 40 years or so is that the duty is owed to the owners of the company. Well, the duty is actually owed to the best interests of the company on behalf of stakeholders or shareholders, and shareholders being a stakeholder.
So what would you say to those that say that stakeholderism may ask too much of companies?
What I would say is that shareholder primacy is asked too little.
In March 2021, BlackRock Investment Stewardship published a short document titled Our Approach to Engagement with Companies on Their Human Rights Impacts. Even though this represents a significant move into the global business and human rights policy debate, some have highlighted that when BlackRock talks about risks that are linked to human rights issues, primacy is given to material risks to business over risks to people. Do you think this approach is still too narrow?
Well, there's an advisory committee to the Sustainable Financial Initiative by the Commission that has introduced the concept of dual materiality. I don't know how far that will fly. In the UN Guiding Principles, we suggest that companies look at salient human rights risks related to their business before those salient risks become material risks. Because acting on the salient risks can reduce not only human rights harm, but also, sort of catastrophic impacts on the material risks. Materiality, the way it is defined now, is too narrow. And either we have to invent a new term or call it dual materiality or call it whatever you will. You know, obviously, businesses need to stay in business in order to be businesses, and that means an adequate rate of return. But the time horizon has to be stretched in looking forward, and also the impact on people and environment need to be considered. Otherwise, there's not going to be any business opportunities for business in the future.
Since the unanimous endorsement by the Human Rights Council, the IBA has promoted an active role of the legal profession in the implementation of the UNGPs. lawyers are the guardians of the rule of law, and wise counselors should go beyond the black letter of the law. How can lawyers navigate this fragmented legal framework characterized by a smart mix of soft law and hard law?
Well, some lawyers have been doing a pretty good job at it now for quite a while. When we were developing the guiding principles, we launched a corporate law project that involved some two dozen leading law firms from around the world to help us understand what the legal frameworks are in different jurisdictions and what human rights due diligence process should look like. And that was enormously helpful to us because we were able to draw on that experience and write it into the guiding principles. The IBA was exceedingly helpful in disseminating the guiding principles and the learnings that we had developed to the broader community of business lawyers across the world, and brought this to the attention of lawyers in-house or external who advise companies on these matters. And it has helped, I think, tremendously in the dissemination of these ideas. And also in, if I can put it in this way, the legitimation of these ideas, because they recognized early on that, yes, you know, these really are helpful in the interest of the company if we follow these procedures, and because in the long run, we'll have less trouble.
Which goes back to the concept of dual materiality, I guess.
Right, right.
Thank you. I think really looking at where we are now, we've got the 10-year anniversary point this year of the adoption of the guiding principles. And of course, we know that there's a UN working group that is looking to map out the decade of action ahead. What impact and changes do you foresee, and what do you see in terms of challenges over that next decade? And also, if I may, what impact do you see coming from the Biden administration in addressing this now?
Well, I think, let me start with the second. The Biden administration, I think, is basically sympathetic to these issues, but has not had the opportunity to even think about them, being confronted with domestic crisis and an increasingly unstable international geopolitical situation. I suspect that when the EU initiatives actually take force or come into force, the Biden administration will obviously have to take a position and so on. But until now, the one thing that they have done is to work with the Securities and Exchange Commission to undo some of the silly orders that they got from the Trump administration on ESG investing. That demonstrates that they are sympathetic to these issues, and they do believe that ESG is real. So on the Biden administration, I think when the time comes, they will do the right thing. Now, with regard to your first question about the UN working group, I don't know what their plans are, but if I were asked, I would say there are three major gaps that still need to be addressed. One we've already touched on, it's the SME gap. We keep saying that, yes, we need to have a specific framework for SMEs, not simply sort of try to scale down what we expect large companies to do. But we've never sort of started with SMEs and sort of worked our way up. So that would be one. The second has to do with what value chains look like when you see them from the bottom up. You know, we expect that, you know, the tier one suppliers will impose conditions on the second tier and so on down the chain. And we don't really know if it actually works that way. And so flip it around and start looking from the bottom up. What is it that constrains an entity in a supply chain from doing the right thing? Is it that the buyer is not paying enough? Is it local political issues? Is it lack of capacity? Is it bribery and corruption, et cetera, et cetera? So we've always looked at it from the top down, and I think it's time to sort of look at it from the bottom up. And the third challenge, I think, is posed clearly by China. Western companies operating in China, you know, H&M, for example, in Sweden, recently had its shops in Beijing. There were demonstrations and damage was done. And H&M responds to criticism back home that it may be sourcing cotton from Uyghur areas of the country. And then the Chinese government punishes them because they say that this is a possibility. That's not something that business can work out by itself. That really is going to require that governments also step in and figure this one out. It's a really tough one.
Yes, I think this is an ongoing challenge, both in terms of that exact example and the political dimension to that, the question of sanctions that then can emerge where there will be different courses of conduct. I mean, it's interesting to see what happens in the US with the example of what the US Customs and Border Control have been doing with the withhold release orders. I think that has produced some interesting results. Do you see that as being a viable long-term plan in order to tackle issues? So, I mean, this obviously relates to forced labor in the supply chain suspicion or concern, but just wondering if you've got any thoughts on that.
Well, it's only a partial solution. I mean, given the magnitude of trade, even now when it's gone down so much, given the magnitude, the capacity to do these inspections isn't nearly enough to make an adequate impact on what gets in.
What could the impact of the European directive be for rights holders and their access to justice?
Well, up until now, rights holders have been able to achieve limited access to justice at the discretion of judges. But, you know, will a judge accept a case, you know, of something that happened in a foreign country by foreign actors who happen to be related to a Dutch or a British or an American company? That's been hard. Cases drag on. The procedural stages can last, God knows how long, a decade or more. And many of them never reach an examination of the merits. With the EU hard law in place, that will make it it easier because it's no longer simply at the discretion of a judge. There are explicit rules of how to gain access to a court, and the court is required to take the case if it's a legitimate a case. And so it should reduce the burden somewhat, at least in terms of EU courts. Or courts within the European Union.
I was asked by companies whether the European law might lead to excessive litigation. What is your view on this?
Well, what I would tell your friends in the companies, if they do the due diligence right, they won't get any lawsuits.
Did you want to ask anything, Maria-Pia, about remedies within companies? I know we talked about access to justice more broadly, but I know you're quite interested in the remedy part.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because I think... up to now, you know, companies have established local grievance mechanisms, but we know very little about them. We don't know how well they function, whether they meet the criteria of Guiding Principle 31, which sort of lays out what the grievance mechanisms should look like. Now, again, with hard law coming into place, I suspect companies will pay much more attention to local grievance mechanisms to make sure that they catch potential issues before they escalate into major cases. The interesting thing about this piece or these two pieces of hard law is that they may encourage softer approaches at the company level that will head off many of the cases that could escalate into more serious human rights situations.
We may need to flip our approach to these issues and consider looking from the bottom up, not only the top down. What constrains an entity in a supply chain from doing the right thing? Is it a financial capacity, local corruption, or even a much bigger political issue? In reality, it's often a combination of many or all of these things. What is clear is that the law in this area is evolving fast, and the path ahead is also clear. Businesses must respect human rights or pay the cost, both reputationally, legally, and financially. Shareholder focus and primacy has evolved into multi-stakeholder interests and investment driving change, with ESG investing, that is economic, social and governance, being the order of the day. Ensuring respect for human rights, reducing harm and ensuring access to remedies have become essential for business. Thank you.